This was the second time that I was saved during my journey by some quite unexpected intervention. The first experience of a similar kind I had in Turkestan, not far from Chotan. Suddenly a horseman, looking majestic and yet humble, had appeared to warn me of a small detachment of cavalry which was out to capture me. I had hidden immediately at the place indicated by the mysterious horseman. The cavalry looked for me in vain, and the mysterious horseman turned out to be unknown to everybody in the district. There are not many Tibetans who would dare to disturb a holy man while he is in a state of pious meditation. Terrible punishment after death would be meted out to a person committing so heinous an offense. The Tibetans think that an abrupt cessation of deep meditation may too suddenly call down the meditating person from the celestial spheres into full consciousness of his materialistic surroundings, and this violent waking up of a person plunged into a state of what we in the West may call deep trance may be most harmful to him. Punishment for disturbing a meditating person is hell. The Tibetan hells are much more uncomfortable than our Western hell. I mean the hell where people are afraid they will go after death. Many people have already made a hell of this life in the West. Tibet is a cold country, and even in summer it is really warm only in the afternoons. The Tibetans therefore suffer much from exposure to cold, and they might consider a hot hell after death a pleasant change. The practical lamas, who have every interest that people should be as much afraid of hell as possible, have introduced therefore the idea of a cold hell, so that everybody may be afraid according to his particular taste. About a week after the experience within the monastery, I attended a rather ghastly show in another monastery. It was very carefully staged, and I heard that the lamas had rehearsed the show day after day for a whole year. So everything went off very smoothly. The lamas danced in the central court of the monastery. They wore grotesque masks representing evil spirits which looked so awful and so live that the Tibetan crowd literally trembled with terror. The lamas wore bright clothes, and an exact copy of the dreadful masks they had on their faces appeared painted on their chests. From the opposite side of the yard there came a procession of sinners, looking thin, miserable, and terror-stricken. The procession broke up, making rhythmical movements of terror. Each sinner was attacked by a host of demons which chased him, while the poor victim shrieked terribly and ran faster and faster. Finally he stood still and writhed in agony while several dozen demons seized him. A queer music, more rhythmical than tuneful, accompanied the scenes. The whole thing was most realistic and made a deep impression not only on the Tibetans but, I must confess, also on the author who watched the proceedings from a corner. I am sure that if the lamas cared to come to the West they could greatly impress a Western audience with this show. The scenes were so striking and well acted that even the enlightened public of the West would not remain indifferent. By such shows the lamas keep alive the fear of hell. Uncomfortable as it is, the Tibetan hell, however, is not eternal. The lamas do not state precisely how long it lasts, since, as they put it, time only pertains to the material world. The world of spirit is timeless. Heaven and hell come in between two successive incarnations, and as soon as the soul of the departed has stayed long enough in heaven or hell to get the reward for his good deeds or the punishment for his sins, it returns to earth to be reborn into the body of a child and start a new existence. Some of the lamas show understanding for these deeper things. According to the lamas whom I heard preach on these matters, a human being is threefold and consists of three parts, viz., A, his gross body, B, a subtle invisible body connected with the gross body and continually modified and influenced through the senses, and C, the individual soul, which is a part of the spirit pervading the whole universe and unchanging and incorruptible by its very nature. When a person dies, the subtle invisible body together with the individual soul leaves the gross body. The less materially minded the dying person is, the easier becomes this process of discarding the gross body. But the lamas point out that nearly all persons are at least to a degree materially minded, and it is advisable, therefore, that a lama should be called when somebody is about to die, since by pious songs and prayers, the reciting of some magic words, and knocking at the crown of the head of the dying person, he may facilitate the painful process of evacuation of the physical body. During life, thoughts and feelings continually influence the subtle invisible body, and after death it retains a taint of all these impressions. It is this subtle body, allied to the soul, that goes to heaven or hell according to the sins or merits of the departed. There, a slow process of disintegration takes place. Every kind or unkind thought, word, or action during life has left some impression on the invisible body, and these impressions must be removed after death by suffering or by enjoyment. As this process of squaring accounts continues, the invisible body disintegrates more and more, until nothing but the unchanging and incorruptible soul, which is a part of the world's soul, remains and again returns to earth to enter the body of a newborn child. I was curious to find out what the lamas thought of the actual aspect and constitution of the subtle invisible body. As I only conversed with the common people and the Tibetan hermits, about whom I shall write in the last two chapters of this book, and never addressed the lamas, since the latter are much more dangerous than all their cold and hot hells put together, I had to listen to numerous talks to pupils and occasional conversations between the lamas themselves to find out something more about the matter. However, it seems to me that when the lamas no longer talk vaguely about the subtle invisible body, but begin to provide details, their concrete descriptions of its actual aspect and characteristics vary a great deal. One lama whom I heard speaking declared that the subtle body consisted of invisible ethers which circulated at great speed, so fast in fact that the sight of them made a clairvoyant's head turn. The invisible ethers circulate in a very large number of small vessels which run out from a common center. When a pupil asked how many such vessels existed, the lama answered, 72,000. But I distinctly remember another lama having said in reply to precisely the same question that the number of vessels in the subtle body was 7,272 bum, 1 bum, 100,000. That is to say 727,200,000. In answer to the questions of pupils as to where the center of the vessels is located, the answers given by various lamas in different monasteries were far from being identical. One lama said it was in the heart, another said it was in the navel, and a third said that the center shifted according to the varying corporeal characteristics of the individual in question. Seeing that all these contradictions exist, it is small wonder that most lamas adopt an abstruse and ambiguous way of expressing their thoughts, and complicate matters whenever their pupils begin to put concrete questions. The wise men of Tibet are different. Their answers are always simple and straightforward. They never try to complicate matters. In most cases, the latter course is only resorted to by people who are anxious to cover up their ignorance or who wish to mislead or take advantage of others. The reader need not imagine that most lamas are interested in these deeper things. Those who approach such matters at all are only a small minority. Most lamas are very ignorant. All they can tell the people is to recommend them to murmur as often as possible the four holy words, Om Mani Padme Hum, as every time these six holy syllables are murmured a thousand sins are forgiven you. Apart from murmuring the holy formula, confession of sins is a widespread practice in Tibetan monasteries and, seeing the practical and business-like ways of the lamas, I do not doubt that confession by telephone will be unhesitatingly authorized by them as soon as Tibet adopts telephonic communication on a large scale. Perhaps there will then be an extra charge for confessing sins to them Kenpo, the abbot, direct, this method of confession being considered a little more efficacious by the Tibetans. Often the abbots of Tibetan monasteries are former businessmen or local governors, and in some cases even former brigands. Having become abbots, they make an effort to be good and virtuous because they think it pays spiritually to be good and virtuous. They thus transplant their materialistic attitude of grabbing and getting into the spiritual sphere, a common illusion of many people who call themselves spiritual. The abbots have extensive powers. They see to it that the monks behave properly and that they have no association with women. It is the abbot who distributes the property of the monastery, which is sometimes considerable, as the population of each neighboring district is forced to pay nearly half of their income as a tax to the monastery, the leaders of which in most cases do not seem to care a straw for the other Tibetan authorities and which are often a veritable state within the state. It is the abbot who looks after the distribution of food in the large depot which exists in most monasteries and is supplied chiefly with dried meat. Dried meat keeps good for years in Tibet without necessitating any special method of preservation. The main article of food in most monasteries is dried meat, and yet it is formally forbidden to Buddhists to eat meat. This seems to be a contradiction, but in Tibet the lamas are always right. They have a collection of holy books containing 108 volumes, each volume weighing something like 10 pounds. So it is not difficult for them to find suitable texts to excuse everything they do by taking the letter of their complicated religious texts and overlooking their spirit. The lamas do not deny that it is written again and again in Buddhist holy scripture, "Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not eat any meat." But, nevertheless, they eat meat. They simply say that if a man wants to kill animals for food, he should ask a priest to be present when the animal is killed. Thus the sin of killing will be forgiven to him. I may add in this connection that practically all the wise hermits of Tibet, who in their humble abode have not a single religious text, but who live the spirit of the living Buddha, are vegetarians. This is only possible, of course, for Tibetans who manage to live on very, very small quantities of food. In most cases, no women, apart from old nuns with shaven heads, are allowed to enter a monastery, and even when they leave the monastery for a short time, normal sex indulgence is made very difficult for the lamas. There are exceptions, especially in the case of the Red Cap lamas who are even allowed to marry, but the most powerful sect, which has by far the largest number of adherents, the Yellow Cap sect, is very strict in enforcing chastity of the lamas by making all contact with women impossible. Many things a Westerner would call unnatural go on, therefore, within the walls of a Tibetan monastery. Those who have traveled in the Orient may know that the Oriental view is much more lenient than the Western one. The number of lamas having formed a certain type of union with one of the younger lamas seems to be considerable, and in some monasteries conditions in this respect are such that even a solitary pilgrim is not immune from certain unmistakable invitations extended by some young lamas. Although it would be too much to say that these practices are general, it is obvious that they are fairly frequent. On one occasion when I walked about in the company of a few other pilgrims, we saw a happening which would make an average Westerner repeat shocking. For several weeks in succession, the Tibetans were hardly upset at all. While they calmly discussed the matter, I of course reserved my opinion, as I never opened my mouth within the precincts of a monastery. "This is somewhat unusual," observed one of the Tibetans calmly. "I never thought the lamas could do such a thing," returned another. "Do not forget," put in a third pilgrim, "that the lamas are very wise. Even if they do a thing that seems strange to us, they do it for the good of the world." "I have always been told not to find fault with a lama's actions," said the first pilgrim. "Perhaps these two lamas are very holy," returned the third pilgrim. "They were coming too near to nirvana, and as they wanted to remain in their bodies so as to be able to help the world, they voluntarily committed a sin in a spirit of sacrifice." A devout silence would follow the conversation. The Tibetan pilgrims would look very sheepish and credulous, and I had to take some pains to conceal my merriment. It seems improbable that the lamas conceal women inside the monasteries. Especially, the existence of white women, living with hundreds of rather filthy-looking lamas with whom they are infatuated, seems to me exceedingly improbable. I sometimes wonder what a lama would look like when meeting suddenly a nice young European or American girl in a monastery. He would probably mistake her for a ghost. Most Tibetans are terribly afraid of evil spirits, and they people their whole surroundings with them. When ghosts do much mischief, the lamas are supposed to be the only ones who can offer assistance by driving them away with magic incantations and prayers. There are innumerable millions of evil spirits, but they can be classed, there being 360 different varieties, cataloging all these evil spirits and learning all their names and evil characteristics, and the best method of fighting them is a matter of absorbing study to many Tibetan priests. They have built up the knowledge of ghosts into an imposing scientific structure which greatly baffles the ignorant masses. As about 20% of the population of Tibet are priests and monks, it is rather difficult for all these people to make a living. Where the taxes levied by the priests, the fees for praying and exorcising, the income from funeral rites, the sale of talismans, and the gifts of numerous pilgrims are not sufficient to keep the lamas going, they invent a local divinity having a particularly wrathful and difficult temper which must be propitiated continually to keep away evil influences from the district in question. The people living there naturally defray the expense of those propitiatory practices considered absolutely necessary by the priests in the interests of the people. The lamas even exploit children. When they are about 8 to 10 years old, the future priests are sent to the monasteries. According to Tibetan ideas, a boy is old enough to become the pupil of a priest when he is big enough to scare away a bird of moderate size. The children coming from well-to-do families are treated nicely, but those from poor families are often maltreated and sent out by their teachers to beg, the money collected by them being afterwards taken away by their teachers. One cannot imagine the Buddha treating a poor boy in a way different from a rich one, but his priests often do so. Their prayers are often selfish. Buddha himself could not possibly have encouraged prayers for egotistical purposes, as they turn religion into a farce. When agricultural districts in Tibet are threatened by the effects of drought, the farmers pay something to a few hundred priests who organize processions praying for rain, but people building houses in the same districts want the fine weather to continue, and they pay something to other priests so that they should go about praying for dry weather. Thus hundreds of priests pray simultaneously for rain and for dry weather, which must put their gods into a very embarrassing position, as in spite of all their power they cannot give rain and sunshine at the same time. We may laugh at this, but many civilized people in the West are doing precisely the same thing. Real religion is love. It has nothing to do with such comedies. He who lives the spirit of his religion and not only 5 minutes a week after listening to some uplifting sermon, but every moment of his life, has no God whom he tries to coax and to bribe, he has not his God whom he tries to use as a weapon against his neighbor. Many Tibetan lamas have their own divinity whose name they keep secret, their own God. Mind you, with whom they want to keep the monopoly of entering into contact. It is just the latter type of Tibetan priest who is not always kind in the little things of his daily life. The same applies to many pilgrims, who advance by throwing themselves flat on the ground every 2 yards and sometimes cover distances of 100 or 200 English miles by throwing themselves on the ground every 2 yards. But woe to the pilgrim who is taken ill during such a pilgrimage. His pious colleagues may leave him behind without any help. There is no text formally ordering a pilgrim to help another pilgrim taken ill on the way. And every time he throws himself to the ground, a Tibetan pilgrim, if I may say so, expects some sort of credit entry into his book of virtues. He is very anxious, therefore, not to interrupt his meritorious crawling exercises no matter what happens. The Tibetan robbers never throw themselves to the ground to acquire merit. They do not make any effort to be good and, unlike the pilgrims, they do not even imagine that they are good. Yet, if a member of a gang of Tibetan robbers is taken ill on the way, he is not left behind without any help, but receives assistance. The Tibetan pilgrims, on the whole, seem to be rather sheepish people. They mostly travel in flocks, as they are afraid of brigands and evil spirits. Once, a group of at least 25 pilgrims ran away when they saw me approaching them in the lone solitudes of mysterious Tibet. They were greatly terrified on seeing a lonely man whom they evidently mistook for a ghost. The faster I approached, the faster the 25 adults ran away. I positively felt like a giant routing a whole army. Only a pilgrim can enter practically all the monasteries of Tibet. Even a permit issued by the government of the country would not enable an explorer to enter all the monasteries, especially those situated a long way from the capital. But the pilgrim is always welcome, as the lamas would never turn away a prospective customer. During the course of centuries, the lamas have created a curious blend of business and religion. The day Tibet introduces an industry on western lines, the lamas will probably not hesitate to set up whole batteries of prayer mills driven by electricity and start a prayer subscription business on a large scale. They are so practical that where religious texts are very long, they make several dozens of lamas read out several dozen pages at the same time, each lama reading a different page. Thus, apart from very few exceptions, only the letter of Buddhism prevails and not its spirit. The spirit of the living Buddha is nowadays to be found mostly outside the monasteries with some of the Tibetan hermits about whom I shall write in the last two chapters of this book, but here and there a few priests still remain in the monasteries who live up to the spirit of the living Buddha. In most cases, these sincere men are treated as heretics by their more business-like colleagues. For sincere and uncompromising lamas may remind the other lamas how far they have departed from the spirit of the teachings of the Buddha. Rites and ceremonies are unnecessary, taught the Buddha. Using occult powers for healing or exorcising is a great religious error. That passage is to be found in old authentic Buddhist writings. No wonder that most lamas dislike the presence of men who may remind them of such facts. Specially consecrated food is kept in many temples. The lamas occasionally distribute pills made of rice, butter, and flour, and they claim that such magical rites ensure close contact with the divinities. Although the historical Buddha never said he was divine and only spoke of the divine in man, the divine which is potentially in the heart of every human being, dogmatic Buddhism has turned not only Buddha himself into a god but also his relatives. Lamaistic Buddhism has developed the worship of the Mother of Buddha. In many monasteries there are statues of the Lamaistic Mother of God holding the infant Buddha in her arms. This worship of the Mother of Buddha was gradually elaborated by the Buddhist priesthood throughout the ages. No traces of it can be found in the early centuries of Buddhism. There was no religious hierarchy at all during the first few centuries following the death of the Buddha. There were only some poor group leaders trying to keep alive the spirit of his teaching in the face of ever-increasing religious quackery destined to kill his spirit and to distort his words for the purpose of building up a system for selfish purposes and spiritual exploitation. And there was no successor of Buddha during the first centuries following his death. Nor was there any hierarchical order amongst the group leaders. It was only after the victory of Mahayana that the self-styled successors and vice-gods appeared. Mahayana was based on the assumption that the real message of Buddha was too pure and elevated to have a chance of being rapidly accepted by the masses, and that therefore some sort of right. But it was no longer the Buddhism of Buddha. If Buddha really intended to create a dogmatic religion and an organized belief, why on earth did he not write down his rules himself? Surely a man of the genius of Buddha and brought up as a son of a king knew how to write. But the greatest initiators of the past have never written a line. They probably realized the fact that living realities cannot be imprisoned in texts. Organized Buddhism, as it stands today, is a formidable machinery for exercising power by exploiting fear and credulity, especially Buddhism as it is in Tibet and Nepal. Religion has been perverted more and more in order to establish the authority of its representatives. The lamas are supposed to know everything. When a Tibetan wants advice, he goes to the lamas. Even in matters connected with love and matrimony, the lamas are consulted, and in many cases the Tibetans then go to unmarried lamas of the Yellow Cap sect who are strictly forbidden to associate with women. The Tibetans, on the whole, like to be told what to do. This prevents unnecessary thinking. The lamas greatly profit by this attitude. When a Tibetan puts a question to a lama and the latter does not know what to say, the lama watered down Buddhism should be created for the broad masses, thus ensuring the rapid victory of Buddhism as a system. This was done, and Buddhism spread all right, but it was no longer the Buddhism of Buddha. If Buddha really intended to create a dogmatic religion and an organized belief, why on earth did he not write down his rules himself? Surely a man of the genius of Buddha and brought up as a son of a king knew how to write. but the greatest initiators of the past have never written a line. They probably realized the fact that living realities cannot be imprisoned in texts. Organized Buddhism, as it stands today, is a formidable machinery for exercising power by exploiting fear and credulity, especially Buddhism as it is in Tibet and Nepal. Religion has been perverted more and more in order to establish the authority of its representatives. The lamas are supposed to know everything. When a Tibetan wants advice, he goes to the lamas. Even in matters connected with love and matrimony, the lamas are consulted, and in many cases the Tibetans then go to unmarried lamas of the yellow cap sect who are strictly forbidden to associate with women. The Tibetans, on the whole, like to be told what to do. This prevents unnecessary thinking. The lamas greatly profit by this attitude. When a Tibetan puts a question to a lama and the latter does not know what to say, the lama often acts like a Western physician I know when he is unable to diagnose a disease. He makes an effort to look very wise without saying anything. When asked for advice in a complicated and difficult case, the lamas behave like certain Western lawyers when they are asked to give an opinion on a particularly uncertain and complicated legal issue. They talk a lot without saying anything definite. The lamas are rather tricky and always manage to wriggle out of tight corners somehow with undiminished authority. Here is a verbatim report, freely translated into English, of three conversations I overheard in Tibet. The questioner went to a lama who, like many other Tibetan priests, was reputed to be a clairvoyant. He wished to know what was happening to one of his relatives living far away. Questioner, is he going on well now? Lama, his condition is no longer exactly the same as it was some time ago. Questioner, shall I see him again? Lama, that rests with the gods. Conversation between a lama and a Tibetan who would like to know something about his brother living at a village at a distance of a few hundred miles. Lama, and I am quite certain that you have received news from him immediately, have you not? Customer, no, holy father, I have not. Lama, with unruffled composure, well, then you will hear from him soon. Customer, I am ever so much obliged to you. A critically minded Tibetan comes to a lama to protest. Customer, last month many of you, reverend lamas, offered prayers for rain. Then it rained. Lama, but of course it rained. We prayed for rain and the gods deigned to answer our prayers. Customer, but this time we again brought you much butter, asking you to pray for rain. And this time there was no rain at all. Lama, you cannot question the will of the gods. The gods always know best. Customer, but what shall we do? Lama, bring us more butter and we shall pray again. Meditation is widely practiced in Tibet. It is easy to describe a meditating lama, but it is much more difficult to guess what is going on behind his lifeless face. The meditating lama is seated motionless with bent legs and crossed arms. He keeps his eyes closed, his face is extraordinarily pale and thin. It more often resembles a statue made of wax than a human face. It is so absolutely colorless and lifeless. In this pose the lama remains seated for many hours, and in some exceptional cases for many days at a stretch. The longer a lama manages to remain in such a state of meditation, the greater is his reputation for holiness. Shrewd and practical lamas may be suspected, therefore, of remaining in this saintly position much longer than is really necessary for bringing to a conclusion their pious contemplations. What is going on inside the head of a lama while he meditates? What is the object of his contemplation? Many lamas are very ignorant and I cannot help thinking that they do not think at all while they contemplate. Their state of meditation may mean to them merely a meritorious state of isolation and fasting, and their contemplations may not convey to them anything at all. However, not all the lamas are in that position. Some Buddhist priests have a very definite object in view when they meditate, namely the concentration and hoarding of spiritual energy. I must confess that all my observations in Tibetan monasteries, where I always painstakingly maintained the pose of a deaf and dumb pilgrim, never provided a real key to the purpose and mechanism of those meditation exercises. It was only when I met the wise men of Tibet, about whom I am writing in chapters 5 and 7 of this book, that I got valuable hints regarding the matter. The wise hermits of Tibet consider these contemplation exercises practiced by the lamas as a false method of acquiring spirituality. Spirituality, in their opinion, must be the result of man's inner attitude to life. It must be spontaneous, and not acquired by any special methods or practices. The wise men of Tibet never go into a special pose to meditate,